So it seems that Rina was right. It was a tricky point to reach. It's just to actuate your headset. Thanks a lot, Irina. So maybe we will start. So I will try to. I have to share my slides with you. There is also the slides that I put on the Dropbox, if not Dropbox, the one from the university. The slides are quite similar, but maybe I made a couple of changes. There will be some animation. Okay, so I know that Elise asked me to say when I change the slides, because she's following the presentation using the slides I sent to the university. So the first slide is this is the title. So the title is Photonics-Based Terahertz Sources. First of all, I wanted to present you a larger overview of the terahertz sources. But when I prepared the slides, it was about 100 slides, and it would have taken too much time. So I decided to focus on the terahertz sources that are based on photonics, and because maybe these are the topics that we are addressing in the lab, at least, of course, in the team photo. Okay. So second slide is just a brief outline of the talk. So I will shortly introduce the topic, then go very fast on the direct emission of terahertz waves, and then we will focus on what I've called down conversion of photonic sources, and then make a very brief conclusion. So it will take about 1 hour, I guess. If you want to make a stop or a pause, you can ask. And also, if you have some question, you can ask your question on the chat, but also maybe I won't see them, so you can interrupt me and say something on the microphone. Okay, so third slide. Slide is about terahertz spectrum. So wait, I will try to add a kind of laser pointer. Okay, so can you see the pointer? Okay, thanks. So as you can see on the spectrum, the terahertz waves are here in between RF and microwave, and before the infrared and visible light. So let's say that they are commonly, we speak about terahertz band within 100 gigahertz here, up to, let's say, 10 terahertz. And after that, it's called the infrared and then the visible. Before, the terahertz waves were also called far infrared. Okay, so in terms of frequency, it's 100 gigahertz up to 10 terahertz. But if you're speaking about wavelength, you can see that it's the wavelength is about 300 microns, so it's let's say 300 times larger than the visible, and it's very close, of course, to the microwave wavelength. So let's say submillimeter wavelength. In terms of photon energy, it's very low photon energy. It's 4 MeV, so it's much more smaller than the thermal energy at room temperature. So the equivalent temperature of this energy is 48 Kelvin, so it's quite low. So next slide. It's the slide about different type of applications of terahertz. So on the first line, you can see that I've put spectroscopy. So we can distinguish three different types of spectroscopy. On the left is the high resolution spectroscopy. So this is when you want to distinguish or to analyze some absorption resonance, mainly due to gases. So for instance, here it's a water vapor and HCl, and you can see that the lines are the width of the line is about 1 GHz. So for that, you will need a CW source. I mean, a source with carrier source which is very narrow. On the opposite, in the middle, you have the broadband spectroscopy. This is when you want to analyze, for instance, molecules that are much more complicated and that present some, let's say, less sharper response. For instance, here it's a diclofenac acid. It's a diclofenac that can, it's an acid you can use when you have a mortar. And so, for that, if you want to make this kind of spectroscopy, you can use you can do it, of course, with a narrow boundary source, but you can also try to have a source which presents you a very broadband spectrum. And then you can do the spectroscopy in a single-shot experiment. And now we can also consider ultra-broadband spectroscopies when you want to extend the range up to 10 terahertz or more. So this is for spectroscopy. So starting from the application, you can define the source that you want to use. And there is another important application is imaging and non-destructive control. So if you can see on the bottom, it's an image of one tooth. And so this is on the left, this is the image in the visible. And the other images are made with the carrier. And you can see that even if the tooth seems to be okay, actually there is some water absorption inside, which means that there is a carry. So to do this kind of experiment, what you need is a very powerful source, because you need to have a good contrast. And you can also, on the top, there is also another image. So this image, this is not very clear, but here there is it's a piece of plastic where the letters terahertz are engraved. So this is not real image. This is more when you want to detect change of not absorption, but it's a difference of propagation length. So for that, if you want to do this image, what you need is to control the phase of your source. So for that, you will need to be able to measure the phase. And last application, of course, there is a lot of applications, but here I put the most important one. The last application is telecommunications. For instance, here it's a wireless telecommunication in between two poles. If you want to increase the data rate, let's say if you want to go up to more than 10 gigabytes per gigabytes per second, you need one way to do that is to increase the carrier frequency. Then you can imagine that you will have some wireless telecommunication channel in the region of 300 gigahertz. So this is very important application, and for that you need a very, very stable sources. And another application is the last centimeter transmission or interconnection in between chips. So for that you need a very integrated source, and most probably not an optical one, but most probably source based on electrons. So let's skip to slide 5. So for all of these applications, what kind of source can you use? So here on the slide, I put two sources that we won't use. The one on the right, it's a free electron laser. So it's so huge that it's not very easy to handle. And for instance, I think that in France there is no such sources. On the other side, on the left, it's a kind of tricky source. It's tape. So you take a roll of tape, and you unroll or déroulé in French the tape, and because of triple charging effect, you can have generation of terahertz. Of course, here the power is very, very low and the radiation is incoherent. But it has been detected here in the backside. You can see a bolometer. Okay, so just before starting, another point is that what we call the Carrier's gap. So here it's a plot where we put the average power of different sources versus the frequency. And what you can see is if you're considering the lowest part of the frequency, all of these sources are based on, let's say, electronics. For instance, here you have the GUN diode, and all of these sources are based on the electronic effects, electronic transport, so it's limited by the RC value of the, the frequency is limited by the RC value of the circuit, or by the time it takes for the electron to transit from one electrode to the other. So if you want to reach the high frequency regime, you need to have very small devices because you need to have very small transit time. And if you have a very small device, you cannot handle a lot of power. So this is why mainly the main reason why the power is decreasing when you increase the frequency. On the other side, if you are looking to the optical range, so you have the lasers. So here the problem is not the transport of the electron because it's laser. The problem is that you have to maintain the condition of inversion population to have a lasing effect. And because when you decrease the frequency, you decrease also the effective temperature of the photons, it's very difficult to maintain the inversion population. And this is why mainly the main reason why the power of the lasers is decreasing when you increase the wavelength or you decrease the frequency. So in between these two approaches, you have in the Carrier's range, you have usually you have very low amount of power. So this is why the quest of the Holy Grail, the quest of the Holy Source is still a problem. Okay, so how to generate some terror? So there is, we can consider three different ways. The first obvious one, seems to be obvious, is the direct emission of terror. So we will have a short glance on it. The other one is to start from the electronic and to try to upconvert the frequency. For instance, you start from a GUN diode emitting at 9 GHz and you multiply the frequency by using some nonlinear devices just as a Schottky diode. But each time you multiply by 2 or by 3, you reduce the power of your beam, of your signal. So I will not present this because I don't have enough time, and I will focus on the other part. So it is down conversion of signal coming from the visible or infrared. So next slide is number 8. So let's have a look. A rapid look to the direct emission of Carrier signal. So the first approach is black body radiation. We are all Carrier sources, especially if we have if our temperature is very high. The higher the temperature is, the more infrared wavelengths we emit. But this is valid for black body, but also for any kind of body. But the problem is that if you concentrate to the Carrier's range, you can increase the temperature, but you won't increase so much the spectral density available. So it means that if you are using this black body approach, you will have very, very weak power. So you have, so it's possible. It's possible, and this is commonly used in Fourier transform infrared spectrometer. But usually, the power is very weak, the radiation is not coherent, and of course it's drop bound. But you can make some measurements with that, but let's say it's a lab instrument. If you want to generate some coherent light, so you will go towards lasers. And as I said, it's very difficult to have lasers because of the inversion population constraint. But it's possible, especially if you are using some alcohol for the lasers, for the laser media. And you can buy some such a kind of laser. So this is a laser which looks old, but it's actually new. A new one, but it's very long. It's maybe more than 1 meter long, and it's very, very unstable. But we will see that it's, if you compare here the power available, we will see that it's quite powerful. Let's say that 10 milliwatts is very powerful for us. The other approach is to use semiconductor lasers and to use what we call quantum cascade lasers. So this is a very promising approach, but the problem here is that because of the inversion population constraints, you are limited to work, you are obliged to work below, let's say, 100K if you want to emit frequencies in the next few terahertz region. So this is why here, on the 1 cent coin, you see the quantum cascade laser. It's a very small device, but in order to make it work below, let's say, below 5 terahertz, you need to put it in a cryocooler, so it increases the size, but it also increases the price. So this is very expensive. But this is a very powerful, stable, and maybe it's a very promising, promising source if you want to work, let's say, around 5 terahertz. But below 1 terahertz, it's not working. Okay, so slide 10, I will now focus on the down conversion of photonic source, and we will distinguish two approaches. The first approach is to produce, to start from what I call here CW laser frequency. I mean, a laser that emits in a continuous way, and from that, using two wavelengths, we will be able to generate some terahertz, and the signal will be a sine function. So this is what I call a CW terahertz signal. And then the second approach will be based on the use of femtosecond laser pulses. So of course you will generate terahertz pulses, and we will distinguish two approaches. Okay, so the first approach is to start from here. It's a basic idea. You start from two laser lines. For instance, here, two laser lines that are separated by 2.5 terahertz. They say here the central wavelength is around 1.5 micron. So in the time domain, it gives you a beating. Okay, so it's just a beating of two cosine. And here the period of the beating is 400 femtoseconds. So the idea is that if you are able to detect the envelope of this beating, you will generate, let's say, an electrical beating with this period of 400 femtoseconds. And of course, you have done convert the beating in between the two lasers, and then you have a terahertz line. So considering this approach, you have two problems. What you need is first to have two laser lines. We will see that it's not very difficult, but it's difficult to have very stable lines. And another problem is to be able to detect an envelope, that is changing so fast with a very, very sub-picosecond modulation. So you need a very, very fast detector. So this will be the main limit of this approach. So first, we have worked in the lab around the lasers. I will present you, let's say, 10 slides about lasers. So the first idea, as I said to you, is to use two different lasers. Here it's laser 1 and laser 2. So sorry for really, I changed it to slide. It's slide 12. So you can use two lasers, and then emitting in a different wavelength. You combine these lasers, for instance, in a fiber or even with volume optics, and then you try to detect the envelope of the beating with what I've called here a carrier meter, and then you have a small antenna, a kind of lens, and then you radiate this carrier wave. So from the laser point of view, it's very easy to perform. You just need two lasers. Can be tunable if you have one of these two lasers. One of these two lasers is tunable. You can tune your carrier frequency, but main problem is that it's not stable, because these two lasers are working independently, and you have a smallest shift of one laser frequency make a big difference in the carrier. So the other approach is to have one single laser, but that emits two wavelengths at the simultaneously. So if you can do that, you will have a very stable device, because if there is any, let's say, thermal effect in the laser, it will affect the two laser lines, and probably the carrier wave, which is due to the difference of the frequency, won't be affected so much. It can be very compact, but the problem here will be the tunability, which will be very tricky to obtain. So this work has been first done in the lab, let's say 10 years ago. So it's slide 13. So just a hint here, each time there is a result or a research made in the lab, I put that phénisme, homemade in French, and try to put also the logo of the lab. I also try to put pictures of the people. So maybe sometimes I have forget some people, so I will apologize for that. So at that time, it was a work mainly conducted by Guy with Emily, she was a postdoc at ER in Grenoble. And it was a work of Florent Palas. Florent Palas was a PhD student, and myself. And we had the idea, or Guy had the idea, to start from the laser technology, which is very known, but it was also the technology that Team Photonics was working on. It's a micro laser, and it's based on neodymium crystals, and these crystals are known to have to offer high gain, and also there is a large panel of commercially available crystals. This kind of micro laser can work in the CW regime, or also in the two-switch regime, so that was very interesting. And one of the two problems that we had to handle is first that the central wavelength, so these crystals emit around 1 micron, didn't really match the technology of the RF emitter, but also what Florent had to handle during his PhD work was what we call the gain competition in between the two laser modes. So actually, if you are looking to one crystal, here it's one crystal based on neodymium. If you're looking here on the left, if you're looking to the transitions that are possible, you see that you have two possible wavelengths, one micron and 65 nanometers, the other is 1 micron and 3 nanometers. It will give you a beating of about, let's say, 600 gigahertz, so this is what you want. But the problem is that these two modes are sharing the same energy level here. So when you simulate the life of these modes, you can see that there is one mode here, the mode working at 1.65, which is the most efficient in terms of taking the energy from the, let's say, the media. This mode is living, but at the expense of the other one. The other one is completely killed because it has little bit less efficient. You can compare here this kind of cross section. And it means that the mode here at 1.63 is completely killed by the other. So this is because of game competition. So we had to face this problem. And so Florent had a different proposition. And one proposition was to, the idea was to put two different crystals within the same laser. So here it's a sketch of the laser. So the laser is starting here. There is one mirror here. And then the other mirror is here, M1. And these two crystals, C1 and C2, they are a bit different. Here you can see the base, they are based on neodym, but the host is different. And they are lasing at two different wavelengths, 1.65 and 1.66. So the gain competition is reduced. But we wanted this laser to work in the Q-switched regime, so for that you need what we call the saturable absorber here. And the problem, it was not a gain competition with the saturable absorber, but it was a competition on the wavelength that will saturate the saturable absorber the first. So at the early beginning, the laser was emitting two wavelengths, but not simultaneously. So Guy had this very smart idea to propose to add another laser, what we call it a master laser. And the role of this laser was to trigger the saturable absorber before the absorber being triggered by the wavelength we wanted to have. So it worked. And we can demonstrate here on the top figure of this slide 14, we demonstrated that the laser was working at the two wavelengths. You could have this train pulse of pulses, so it was nanosecond pulses. And we also demonstrate that these different pulses were emitted at the same time, because in a nonlinear crystal, we were able to obtain here the sum frequency degeneration in between 1.65 and 1.66. So that was a proof that we were able to have a dual wavelength laser within the same cavity and produce nanosecond pulses with a quite large, let's say, peak power. But at that time, it was maybe around 2010, we didn't have the technology to transfer this beating into terahertz. So that was the first attempt in the lab produce this kind of lasers for terahertz generation. And very recently, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, Lionel and Lionel Bastard and Jean-Emmanuel and Julien started another project, is to try to take advantage of their knowledge in integrated laser on glass for terahertz generation. That was the work of Nisrin here. So Nisrin, she defended, I think it's 1 year and a half ago. So the idea is to take to use this laser integrated on glass. So this is the picture of one single laser. So you can see that there is a waveguide and there is also a Bragg grating. And this is a picture of a real laser. You can see it's purely glass, and there is here the fiber. And the interesting point is that you can control the wavelength. You can control it in different way. You can change the period of the grating. You can also change control more the wavelengths by controlling the width of the waveguide here. And you can also change it a bit if you change the time of the ion exchange process. And also at the end, once you have your laser fabricated, you can tune a bit the wavelength by changing the temperature of the laser using, for instance, here a Peltier module. So they demonstrate that this approach was feasible by, for instance, here fabricating different lasers. On the left, it's a different laser obtained with different time of ion exchange. So you can see that you can shift a bit the central frequency. So these are laser working in the 1.5 micron range. The other picture is showing different laser produced by changing the width of the waveguide. So you can have a very large tunability, but you can have lasers with different with frequencies that are very different. Right. So that was the first step. So the second step is to try to get some terahertz or let's say sub-terahertz signal from these lasers. So the first idea is that okay, you take two lasers, as I mentioned before, and you combine their wavelengths here in the fiber, and then you illuminate the high bandwidth photodiode. So here it was a photodiode, commercial photodiode, which bandwidth is limited to 70 GHz. And the signal was analyzed by a RF spectrum analyzer. And they demonstrate a lot of generation of a lot of different frequencies. For instance, here there is an example around 55 GHz, but also they demonstrate generation of 5-10 GHz signal. And with another PhD student whose name is Robert Horvath, we designed another detection setup, replacing the photodiode by an ultra-fast photo switch. I will speak about that later. And here it's the tricky point is that the photo switch is a very high bandwidth photo switch, maybe 200 GHz or something like that. And because the RF spectrum analyzer is limited to 10 of GHz, you have to mix your beating. So it's a kind of double mix. First, the beating is already a mix of optical signal, but then you mix this mixing with an RF signal here, just to down-convert the terahertz frequency down to the RF region. Okay, so this is just instrumentation. And they were able to demonstrate a generation of 164 GHz. So that was limited in frequency by the setup. So to summarize, so NISCRI is also developed, designed and fabricated different lasers. So the first idea was, as I said, to use the beating of two lasers, but she also go towards the more smart devices by co-integrating two lasers on one single substrate in order to increase the stability. And she also designed one single laser with made of two different drag grating and two different section of waveguide. So all of these devices were able to produce some RF generation. So just to summarize, with Robert here and Nitin, they were able to produce very different beating frequency. So from, let's say, 5 GHz up to 164, so that was limited by the instrumentation. And then, with the help of Julien Poet, NISCRI was also able to demonstrate some telecommunication application, and she demonstrated multi-gigabyte transmission of RF carriers using this photonics approach. So this is a topic which is very interesting, and we will try to continue on this work and maybe to try to generate frequencies that higher frequency and to apply them to spectroscopy. Okay, so that was about fabricating laser for terahertz generation. And then the problem is, once you have your beating here, how do you get the envelope? So as I mentioned here, it's quite the same problem that we had in radio, or in AM radio. So you have to detect the envelope. So for that, in a classical way, you need a diode and then an RC device, RC circuit to smooth the signal coming out of the diode. So the question here, which nonlinear element is sensitive to optical frequency and fast enough to see the to be able to detect the envelope of a carrier protein? So you need a nonlinear element. When you speak about nonlinearities in physics, you can have resonant nonlinearities or non-resonant nonlinearities. So here we are using both. The first one, resonant nonlinearities, is actually much more something that we all know in this lab. It's the generation of electron and hole pair by absorption of the light in a semiconductor. So this is a resonant phenomenon in terms of physics. And the other, this is a resonant and this is nonlinear. If the response of your device will be nonlinear. And another nonlinear effect is non-resonance, the one that happens in what we call usually nonlinear crystals. And we will see later that we can use also this effect to detect the envelope of the signal. So here, first, we will focus on this absorption of the light by a semiconductor. So just a reminder about the absorption of classical semiconductors. So here we are working, we have shown lasers working at 1.5 micron. So if you want to work at 1.5, usually you are using indium gallium arsenide semiconductors. We have shown some lasers that are working around 1 micron, but at that time, as I said, they didn't have detectors with the bandwidth required for the detection of carrier beating. And we will see later that there is also a lot of application working at 0.8 micrometers. So this will be based on gallium arsenide. So this question of mixers or photodetectors for TW regime, first I will show you some graphs, so slide 20, that for detection which is done at 1.5 micron. About the device, about the components, we will see that we will use some photo switches. I will describe them later. And of course, we will also use photodiodes. But when you are speaking about photodiodes, there is different kind of photodiodes. There is a PIN diode that we all know or we can buy very easily. And there is another kind of photodiode, is the last one on the slide. It's what we call unit traveling carrier. I wanted to show you a bit about this kind of photodiode, even if it's topic that which is not done in the lab because it requires technology which is very complicated, but I think it's a very interesting topic, so this is why I'm going to show you three slides. And these slides have been made by Jean-François Lampin in Lille, in the EUMN, because they are working on this topic and they had very, very good results. So just the idea is that what you want is a photodiode with a very high bandwidth. If you're considering a classical PIN diode here, so this is a kind of diagram of the PIN diode. So usually you excite the light, you absorb the light and you create electrons and holes. And both of these carriers have to travel across the photodiode to enrich their respective electrodes. Until they reach the electrodes, there is still some current. So if you want to have a very high bandwidth photodiode, you need the electrons on the hole to move very fast and to join the electrodes in a very short time. The problem is that usually the holes in gallium arsenide or indium gallium arsenide, the holes are moving much more lower than the electrons. So this reduces your frequency. So the idea of the unit traveling carrier photodiode is to generate the carrier to illuminate a p-dot zone. So that only the electrons are contributing to the current. So because the electrons move faster, you can have a much higher boundary. Let's say you, if you are using a PIN diode, you can find a PIN diode with bandwidth up to almost 100 gigahertz commercially. But if you're using what we call UTC PD, with unit traveling carrier per diode, you can reach, 200 gigahertz. So with the 200 gigahertz photodiode, you can work at 400, you can work above, you will just have lower gain. So what are the typical carrier power they get with such diodes? So it's in this graph, there is a lot of results. And so you can see, it's graph, I think, slide 22. So you can see that there is a roll-off of the emitted power versus the frequency. This roll-off is in the power of minus fourth of the frequency. And just to summarize, you see that it strongly depends on the antenna that you are using. So close to your photodiode, after your photodiode, generally, in the people working in the carrier, they want to radiate this signal in the air. So they are using antenna. So you can see here that there is a lot of different antenna. You can have spiral antenna, you can have bow tie, you can have dedicated odd antenna, and blah, blah, blah. And these antenna can be wideband or prism. So depending on the antenna, you can have in between 1 microwatt at 1 terahertz. And if you are using a resonant antenna, you can increase, in quotes, this power up to 10 microwatts at 1 terahertz, or 1 milliwatt or half a milliwatt around 300 gigahertz. So you can see that this is not very large amount of power. But getting 1 milliwatt at 300 gigahertz allows you to perform, for instance, telecommunication experiments. And for instance, in Lille, with using these photodiodes, and especially the last one, they were able to demonstrate communication over more than 100 meters around 300, I think it was 300 gigahertz or 200 gigahertz. Okay. Is there any question or remarks? It's okay for everyone. No, c'est Quentin. Why? Okay, thanks. Thanks for the like. okay, let me continue. Okay, so don't put too much light for time. Difficult for me to be concentrated. So next step is there is a other kind of device we can use to detect the envelope of this carrier beating. The other device is called the photo switch. So it's much more sleek. So it's still a semiconductor device. So it's much more simpler than the photodiode. Here there is a sketch. So in gray, it's a semiconductor that can absorb your light. And in gold, these are electrodes. And you can bias these electrodes with voltage. And so you need to use a semiconductor which is resistive. So if you don't illuminate the semiconductor, so you don't have any current, once you illuminate your semiconductor, you create electron hole pairs. Of course, you have now some possible current. So if you illuminate the device with a laser pulse or a beating, you will have a beating or a pulse generated in current. So what are the advantages of this photo switch as compared to the photodiode? It's quite easy to fabricate. There is, you don't need all the fabrication steps to produce your PN junction and so on. Another thing is that you can see that there is no internal field. I mean, because there is no junction, if you don't bias the device and illuminate it, it won't work. So this is a device that which is working only if you have two signals, one optical signal, one electrical signal. Here, in this case, on the slide, it's a DC bias, but it is a signal, an electrical one. So how can we also you can reduce the capacitance of the device, but the cons is that the quantum efficiency is very, very low. You won't generate so much power with that. So the question is, why it can be efficient for carrier frequencies? Because you can use here what we call a semiconductor with what we call short carrier lifetime. It means that the bandwidth of the device won't be limited by the transit time, but it will be limited by the carrier lifetime in the semiconductor. So it is a topic where we have made a lot of research, especially we characterize a lot of semiconductors. Of course, we didn't make the device because we didn't have any technology, but we had collaboration with labs that were growing this kind of strange semiconductor in which you want to have the shortest carrier lifetime. It's exactly the opposite of the people who want to fabricate, photovoltaic cells. You need here the shortest lifetime possible, but you need also to have a material which, so this is quite tricky. And usually what you are the, so there is a lot of approach, but one main approach is to grow a thin layer of gallium arsenide using molecular beam epitaxy, but you're keeping the substrate at what they call low temperature. Low temperature is about 200 degrees Celsius. In the chamber. So, and you use a mix of gallium and arsine, which is not stoichiometric. You grow your layer with more arsenic, so you have a non-stoichiometric layer. So there is a lot of defect because of arsenic. So all these defects, they act as electron trap. So here our work with myself and Jean-Louis was to characterize such semiconductor, and we were able to show that there is some gallium arsenide that can have electron lifetime lower than 1 picosecond. So with that you can do ultrafast detectors, and that has been known for years by some. For instance, here it's a paper from the MIT, from the slide 24. It has been published in 1995, and it's one of the first demonstration of CW carrier generation up to 3.8 terahertz using such a device based on low temperature ground gallium arsenide. So here the laser is it's a pair of pi-type lasers, so it's CW pi-type lasers. And you can see the roll-off of 12 dB per octave. And that gives you a very, very low amount of power. So as we know, the device has a very low efficiency. So it requires further improvement if you want to increase the efficiency. We will see later. And we are also working on that. Okay, so even if it's not very efficient, you can build some spectrometer. So there is some commercial spectrometer. So we have, since a couple of months, we have one in Le Bourget. It's the CW, what we call CW Terrier system. And we, so it's based on two DFB lasers, and you can tune one. And the TRF emitter here and the TRF receptor here are based. So I think the TRF emitter is a photodiode, and the detector is a photo switch. Yes, you can use the photo switch as detector. As I said, it's a device which is only producing current if you have two signals, the wavelength, the optical beating and the TRF and an electrical signal. But the electrical signal, which is here to accelerate your TRF, can be TRF signal that you want to detect. So this device can be used either as emitter or detector. So here we can see a spectrum which has been obtained by changing the wavelength of one laser. So this is a spectrum ranging from 200 GHz up to 1.8 GHz. And I don't know, maybe it requires you 1 minute or something like that to record this spectrum. Okay, so this is the end of the first approach, is to produce CW TRF signal. And as I show you here, you can have a tunable system, but it will, and you can have also very thin, very good frequency accuracy, so in the resolution of your system can be below 1 GHz. So the other approach is to produce THz in the pulsed regime. So here, if you go back to this picture, so it's slide 26, so we start from the laser spectrum, which is not due to two lasers. It's one single laser, but here it's a laser with a spectrum which is broadband. Here, for instance, 2 THz. And it means that in the time domain, you have a pulse. You have a laser pulse. So here, it's a femtosecond laser pulse. So you have in orange, you have a carrier, and you have the envelope of the pulse. And once again, if you are able to detect the envelope, then you will produce an electrical pulse, which spectrum lies in the center around zero. And it will go up to 2 THz, let's say here in the picture, 1 THz. Okay? So here, this is done with a femtosecond laser. So there is a lot of commercially available lasers, femtosecond lasers, now. Since the 90s, you have this first laser on the left. So it's like 27, sorry. On the left, it's TiTouch laser. So this is commercially available since the 90s. And these lasers are powerful, very stable, and they produce 100 femtosecond pulses at a repetition rate which is 100 megahertz. It means that you have a lot of pulses per second. So even if you don't have a lot of TRF power, you can average your signal 100 million times per second. So you can have a very good signal to noise ratio, even if you don't produce a lot of power. So basically, this is why it was a kind of renaissance of the TRF due to this approach. Because until the 90s, the main approach to produce TRF was the use of Fourier transform spectrometer, as I said, based on black body. So it was very unstable and blah, blah, blah. But here, with the approach of the laser here, people were able to produce broadband signal, but it's a very, very, in a very, very stable manner. So maybe this is why the TRF technology and science emerged from the 90s. So then 20 years ago, or maybe more, we can have a lot of different lasers. So here I present you the three of the four femtosecond lasers we have in the lab. So we have such type of laser. We have a laser working at 1.5 based on fiber technology. And we have also, an amplified system, which is based on bypass, but which is able to produce 5 millijoules per pulse. So this is very, very large energy, the first laser here that I show you is Q nanojoule, but here you can have Q millijoule per pulse, and we will see that it can give you pulse energy power density up to almost 1 terawatt per square centimeter. Okay, so we decided not to work on the lasers. Of course, there is some people who are still working on this kind of laser, especially to have both of the two worlds, I mean very stable and very high repetition rate and very high power. Okay, so this is another story. So the main problem was at that time not to get the laser. You just need let's say 100 kilo. The problem was to have the device that allows you to generate the characters. So once again, we will go back to this photo switch. So here it's another picture, another sketch of the photo switch. In yellow, it's a gold electrode, and in gray, it's still a semiconductor. It is gallium arsenide, as I've shown you. And you can see here that there is no antenna. There is only a small gap here in between the two electrodes that are separated by, let's say, 5 or 10 microns. And you illuminate this gap. And so you generate all your carriers here in this gap. And this is the cross section of the device. This will generate a pulse of current. But thanks to Earth, it will also radiate. Okay, so you will have a radiation proportional to the time derivative of the current that you generate thanks to your laser. So this radiated pulse will be your terahertz signal. And so we studied we studied this phenomena, we tried to modelize it, and this was done with Lionel Dupilaret, Frédéric Garret, Jean-Louis and myself. We were much younger than on this. Maybe Frédéric, it was almost like that. He was almost like that. Okay, and so we tried to, so it was the topic of Frédéric PhD at that time. And so we were able to produce such signal. So you can see here you have this signal, so it's like 29, and you can see that this is a bipolar signal. If you think about that, it's just the time derivative of the Gaussian pulse. If you think about the Gaussian pulse, okay. Here there is a start from the negative, but you have to switch it, which is negative should be positive and positive should be negative. But if you really think about that, it's time derivative of a Gaussian pulse, almost Gaussian. So it means that in the photo switch, the pulse, the current pulse that is generated is almost a Gaussian of duration less than, let's say, 2 picoseconds. So the time derivative of this pulse is like that, and you can propagate it in the air, you can detect it, and then if you make the Fourier transform, you have this kind of spectrum, which go up to 4, let's say 5 terahertz, you reach the noise level of your experiment, and you can see here a lot of small lines. So these are the lines due to water vapor absorption. And so typically the power is very low, it's 2 microwatts over the whole range. But as I say, the repetition rate is high, so you can integrate your signal and have a very, very good signal to noise ratio, sufficiently good to make some spectroscopy experiment. So that is another story, maybe another seminar about spectroscopy. So let's go back to the device that enable us to produce. So we were working in parallel with Frédéric. So Frédéric was working on the use of this signal to make some spectroscopy. And I was working with for instance, Hervé. Hervé Ezeb was a PhD student in 2004. So we were working on the antenna that were here to generate the signal. So we tried to test different shape of antenna. We show different experimental condition. And at that time, so we were able to produce 400 nanowatts, not very high. But it was collaboration with some Lithuanian colleagues that started to have to produce this kind of antenna commercially. Okay, so now this is a topic that has been it's quite old, but now we are coming back to this topic in another frame. So it's a collaboration with Institut Nel. And so we had the idea to try to increase the efficiency of the device. So once again, we are starting from gallium arsenide and from low temperature ground gallium arsenide. But instead of only illuminating a planar device, we decided to try to improve the efficiency of the device by by using some nanophotonics approach and plasmonic effect. So I will describe you this component. So this is a work that has been done by Yorgos. Yorgos Georgiou was a postdoc in the lab during 3 years, and he was working also with Nel. And now he's still working with Nel and CEA on almost the same topic. So the device is like that. You can see here this small, it's not building, this pillar of gallium arsenide. And so this is a periodic array of pillars. And in between the pillars, there is some polymer. And the polymer is here to sustain a top electrode, which is made of ITO. And there is also some silver on top of each pillar. And actually, the sketch is a bit wrong. The ITO is over the silver. So the ITO is here to connect electrically all the pillars. And then at the bottom, in between the pillars, you have another silver electrode. So this device, you have two electrodes, and you have in between, you have some LT gallium arsenide pillars. So why do you have these pillars? You have to think about this structure as a waveguide, an optical waveguide. So here is another sketch. In gray, these are the pillars. In pink, the polymer. And you have a kind of effective waveguide. And because of the periodicity of the array, you can, if you illuminate this device, so you have a laser which will come perpendicularly to this device. And because of the periodicity, the light will be coupled like that. Light is coming like that, and then coupled into the waveguide. So you can excite some widened mode here in blue, propagating in the effective media, and you can also excite some Fabry-Perot resonance here in between the two electrodes, because the two electrodes are reflecting the light. And then also you can have here a kind of plasmon electron resonance. So basic idea is that you have a lot of resonances, waveguide resonances, Fabry-Perot resonances, and plasmon excitation. And the goal is to try to have the maximum absorption of the light into the gallium arsenide. So here, these are some simulation results, and we have shown that almost 99% of the light is absorbed within the gallium arsenide here. So this will strongly increase the efficiency of the device. So this is still some simulation results. In black, it's a response. This is a pulse current of classical LT gallium arsenide photoswitch. And then here in red, it's a result of our device, and you can see, we can hope. So this is simulation result, that the current peak current is 50 times larger. So now this work is under evaluation by in a journal. We have fabricated the device, and we are going to test, try to, and hope that it will be at least, let's say, 10 times larger. If it's 10 times more efficient than the real one, then the planar one is the... Okay, so that was just an highlight of a result which is still under activity. Okay, so based on all this pulse terahertz approach, you can build some spectrometer. And so here are two examples of commercial spectrometer. And the one on the left, with slide 32, it's coming from the company TerraView. And we are going to buy a new one like that for the platform Platera in Lebanon. Okay, so I hope that you're still living, alive. I hope you don't think it's too boring. Probably it's interesting, but after 1 hour, it's difficult. So we will now go towards the last part of the seminar. So it's still we are still considering terahertz pulse generation, but now we are not. We won't use semiconductor. As I mentioned to you, we need a nonlinear effect, and we will use nonlinear optics in crystals. And this topic has been introduced by Ronchen in 1876. And at that time, it's a book. It's a book renowned by people working in nonlinear optics. And at that time, he said, secondly, we hope to find a new far infrared source which is superior to those presently available. The second aspect is clearly of practical importance. Let us therefore elaborate a little on it. And I shall say that we are still elaborate a little on it 40 years after. Okay, and we are still in the hope to find a new far infrared source which will be superior to those presently available. So this is still the quest of the Holy Grail. So it makes the travail quotidien of a lot of research. Okay, so just a few equations. It's not to bore you with equations, it's just to remind what is nonlinear optics. So if you start from the on top of the slide, it's slide 34, it's a Helmholtz equation. Helmholtz propagation equation. So here P is the polarization of the media that you are illuminating. And in this polarization, you can have the first term, which is a linear term. And if you had nonlinearity, so you will have a new component that are due to the mixing of a different incoming electromagnetic field. And if we consider the case of two waves, coming at frequency omega 1 and omega 2 here, in a nonlinear crystal in which there is a chi2 component, it means that allows you to have the product of the two electrical fields. So you will have a new component, of course, second harmonic generation. So maybe Irina will tell you about that in another seminar. You can have some frequency generation, but what is interesting for us here is that you can have different frequency generation between omega 1 and omega 2, and you can also have what we call rectification. So rectification is not really clear in this on this slide. It's, let's say, kind of in this example, where the waves are sinusoidal, the rectification is a constant term in frequency. But if you imagine that you modulate each of the two electrical fields, the rectification will give you once again the envelope. Okay. just one other slide with some theoretical results. It's just try to see the difference in between the two last terms, different frequency generation and rate expression. So I have built a small model, so it's a small theoretical model. So once again, it's the Helmholtz equation, but now it's written in, not in time, but in frequency. So the nonlinear term is here, and I have assumed that we were using a laser pulse here, sketched in red, so it's light but in time. So because this pulse has a large spectrum, in the nonlinear term, there is a term here, S, which is proportional to the laser spectrum. So in the nonlinear term, you can see also there is a chi2, which is based, which is a nonlinear effect in the crystals. E square laser is proportional to the power of the peak power of your laser. And there is some propagation term of the carrier wave. No, sorry, it's not the carrier wave, it's the propagation term of the nonlinear term, which propagates, and this is very important. It propagates at the frequency, at the carrier frequency you want to create, but the velocity at which it propagates is the velocity of the incoming laser pulse. So this is very, very important. In this equation, in the Helmholtz equation, the term that will give you your carrier is propagating in the crystal at the velocity of the optical laser pulse. And big equation. Just remind, just for, focus on the red term. Yeah, red term. So here's an equation that gives you the amplitude of the carrier that you can generate. Okay, let's focused on the red term. So first, the larger the nonlinear coefficient of the crystal is, of course, the larger the amplitude of your carrier field is. Right. Then, the laser peak amplitude. Once again, the peak amplitude of the laser, peak power, So if you are using large peak power, you will increase your carrier field. And then it also depends on that critical here on the spectral density, so it means it depends on your laser. But the new term, the very, very important term in nonlinear effect is the last one. Here it's delta k, is what we call phase mismatch. So here it's, as I said, you can consider that the nonlinear term propagates at the group velocity in the velocity of the incoming laser pulse. But let's say naturally in the crystal, the carrier wave won't propagate at that velocity. It will propagate at the phase velocity in the carrier at the carrier frequency. So there might be a mismatch, in between these two velocities. So it means that you won't have a cumulative effect in the crystal. So I tried to simulate this, just give you a kind of feeling of what's happening. Okay, just consider the equation. So I just put the square of the equation to produce the intensity or the power of the carrier beam. And here what is plotted, so it's the maximum intensity of this equation versus the thickness of the crystal. So let's say we are using the same crystal. So here it's, for those who know, it's zinc fluoride, but we increase the thickness of the crystal. First result is for small crystal of 30 microns, then 120 microns, and so on. And you can see that there is a square law given by this term here. And of course, the thicker the crystal is, the higher the power. But let's see now what's happening on the spectrum of the carrier wave. As I said, we are illuminating the crystal not with a single beating, but with a pulse. So we will generate pulse. With a pulse, have a large bandwidth. But what happens is that the bandwidth is also strongly depending on the thing. If you are using the smaller crystal, you will have a large spectrum generated. Here, it's spectrum ranging from, let's say, 1 terahertz up to 4 terahertz. But you have a small power. If you want to increase the power, you will need to reduce the size of to increase the size of the crystal, but it will reduce the spectrum. And if you go towards millimeter long crystals, so 2 millimeters for it's not very large, but for the laser it's very, very large. You will see that you will produce a terahertz spectrum which is, let's say, almost single frequency. So the longer the crystal is, the thinner the spectral bandwidth is. So this is what we call when the crystal is small, you don't have a lot of power because you don't have a lot of, let's say, cumulative effect in the crystal. So this is what we called rectification. But the longer the crystal is, the narrower the spectral is, and we will go towards quite the same result as a pure difference, as the difference of two pure laser lines. Okay. Just to summarize, thick crystals, high power, thin crystals, large terahertz. So the material in this case is very, very important. We have seen here the importance of the thickness. We have seen, but not very clear, but the importance of the group velocity. And it is also the nonlinear effect is very important. So you have a list of common crystals and so with different parameters. And you can choose, or you should choose your crystals depending on what you want. If you want to produce high power, high bandwidth, blah, 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 blah. So this is a small topic of research, but this is still a topic. So we are collaborating with Institut Nel and the team of Benoît Boulanger mainly, and with Emily and Jean-Louis, and we have characterized a dozen of different nonlinear crystals. So we have characterized them in the terahertz domain. And we had the absorption and also the refractive index. And in Nel, they characterized it in the visible, and then they also made their calculation to determine the best experimental configuration for terahertz generation. In this case, by using different frequency generation. So this is a informal collaboration, and this is still under progress. And so in the lab, we have also tried to use different, or let's say, new crystals. And for instance, this is the work of Gizem and Farah, mainly. They have worked on terahertz generation in Langatat crystals. So this is a crystal provided by Kristallinov. And this is a crystal used because of its piezoelectric properties. So they use these crystals in this setup. So here we use the amplified system, you know, the laser which produces very high energy pulses. And the crystal is here to generate the terahertz, and then they detect terahertz with zinc telluride. And they were able to show here, when comparing the results obtained with Langatat with zinc telluride, that okay, the power is much lower, but there is no saturation effect. And Langatat is a crystal known that it is known because of its superior properties in terms of handling a lot of power. So the signal is linear till almost 1 terawatt per square centimeter, and also the damage threshold is very high. Few years ago, Gwenaël worked on another topic, demonstrate that using the the good crystal with here is a good orientation. You can generate Pitaya, and the fact here is that you can completely control the polarization of your hair pulse by controlling the polarization of the optical beam. You have to know that this is very difficult in the TRF domain to control the polarization. There is no half wave plate, quarter wave plate, and so on in the TRF region. So if you can control your polarization purely in the visible or infrared domain, it's very smart. So using such a crystal, the Quenelle demonstrate that you can rotate your TRF polarization state just by rotating the polarization state of your laser. Okay, almost the last application. Another application, so this is a quite new application. It's what we call optical rectification TRF imaging, so in French it's ORT. The idea is here is to probe and image the internal structure of a material by probing its nonlinear local properties through TRF generation. For instance, here you put a sample. You assume that this sample can generate some TRF. You illuminate it very strongly. It generates TRF, and then you scan the sample and you see if there is any difference in the response. And it was done by Federico, who was a postdoc in the lab 2 years ago, and he made kind of image of a sugar grain. So this is the image of the sugar grain, but it's not an image obtained in the visible, it's an image obtained in the TRF. So the advantage here is that you can make the image of your device, but you can also sense the TRF properties of the device. Okay, so this more recently, this has been also investigated in what we call the periodically pulsed KTP. So this is a work done by Given with Emily. So this strange picture, for those who don't know, it's a sandwich. It's a nonlinear crystal, but it's kind of sandwich of different area where the orientation of the crystals has been changed by 180 degrees. So it means that the nonlinear properties of the crystals are all along the crystals they are the same, but sometimes the sign of the nonlinearity changes. So the idea is to illuminate the crystals in the transverse region, usually illuminating the longitudinal along the main axis. But here you illuminate perpendicularly to this axis and you record the TRF wave. So for instance, if you illuminate it in the plus, I mean here in the gray part, you have this black signal. So this is the temporal shape of the TRF signal. And if you illuminate it just on the nearest region where the opposite, the sign of the nonlinearity opposite, you have the same signal but reversed. So the sign of the signal gives you an idea of the sign of the nonlinearity. So by scanning the crystal with the laser, Gizem was able to reproduce a kind of image of the nonlinear coefficient of the device, but by the TRF signature of the device. So this is a very beautiful result. And okay, last slide, almost. Thanks to these nonlinear crystals, you can reach a very, very large peak power of the TRF pulse. So here it's an old work done by some German guys who they were using higher and higher energy, optical energy, and they were comparing the peak power obtained with photo switches in blue or with nonlinear crystals in red. So you can see that at a very low power, the photo switches are much more superior, the rest is much more efficient. But when you you are reaching the highest optical peak power, there is almost no saturation of the effect in the nonlinear crystals, and then you can reach very, very high energy. So this is a topic that we are not really addressing in the lab with through the use of crystals, but we decided to try to generate some terahertz in plasma. So this is a work mainly performed by Bastien and Maxime, and with the help of Gwenaël and Farah for this specific experiment here. So the idea is very simple. So this is maybe the most simplest terahertz setup that we can have in principle. The idea is to mix. So this is here an optical pulse, and this is a copy of the optical pulse but obtained by second harmonic generation. So you make the interference of these two pulses, and this creates you some plasma. So even without interference, you have plasma. If you focus, you have so much energy in the pulse that you can ionize the molecules of the air, so you create a plasma. But if you had to this plasma, if you had this second harmonic signal, it gives you some nonsense. You break the symmetry of the plasma, the geometrical symmetry of the plasma, and you are able to produce some terahertz. So this is here a sketch of the setup. And the first results obtained, so this is a terahertz signal obtained only in hair. So here, hair is a nonlinear material. So we were looking for smart materials, but actually hair is only the very basic nonlinear media. But for that, because the nonlinearity is very low, you need very, very high peak power. And you can increase or decrease the efficiency of the process by doing it instead of air, doing it in different gases. So they show that using helium reduces the efficiency of the process, and using nitrogen increase. So once again here, thanks to the nonlinear effect, you can either generate terahertz, but you can also, the generation of terahertz is also a probe of your media. Okay, that was the last slide. The idea is, thanks to this approach, to have very, very large broadband with signals. So here are some results obtained from by a Danish team. They demonstrate that you can have pulses with very, very high broadband till 30 terahertz, and they were able to produce, to have some results in spectroscopy, infrared spectroscopy. As I showed you in the very first slide, this is something that you can have, you can want to do. Ultra broadband spectroscopy. Okay, so just conclusion. We have shown that you are using photonics, you are able to produce CW or pulse terahertz signal. And this photonics approach offers you a large panel of possibilities, because you can have tunability of lasers, you can also work on the line width of the laser, you can also have a let's say pulse or nanosecond regime. And concerning the broadband sources, you can have ultra stable terahertz pulse. So even if the power is not very high, you can have very good signal to noise ratio. You can also have potentially very, very high peak power, or as we have seen here in the last slide, very large bandwidth. Okay, at the end, I wanted to acknowledge all my colleagues from the lab, and also my colleague from Lille, and also Antoine and Grégoire from Team Photonics. At the end.